thank you very much for coming to the series, The Jew at War. The other series sounded very interesting also. Maybe I'll stay for the second hour. I wish I could. But I want to thank Loretta once again for setting up the opportunity, working things out with Beth Emeth, making copies of sheets, and generally making everything available. Loretta, thank you for doing this. There are some sheets around the table. There are some copies around.
If you printed out your own, please don't take one of these.
Please make sure that we actually have your correct email address. I don't know if it's listed on the sign-in sheet. If you received email from me this week with the digital copy of the sheet in advance, then I have you on the list. If you didn't receive it, then I don't have you on the list. In particular, there was someone whose email address ended with solarsh.com that bounced back to me. So if that happens to be your email address, then please make sure that it's corrected. Sorry? Okay. So please let her know, because I have no way to let her know. Okay. As always, I am recording the class, and I intend to put the audio online in a way that you'll be able to download it. So I expect to email out the link afterwards, so you'll be able to have that. I'm going to try to let this be a mix of text and discussion. I say that with pretty much every topic, and sometimes it works better, sometimes it does not work as well. Depending on the size of the group, that tends to affect it a lot. I'm going to do the best I can to allow for that, but still keep things moving along. In the event that you had something that you wanted to discuss that we just didn't get to within the class time, please do email me. I would love to follow up by email. In the past, I've given out my cell phone also, but realistically, it's much easier to reach me by email. I tend to keep my phone silent or off. Those are the two modes. So email tends to work better. Okay, here's what I'm hoping to accomplish in the next 6 weeks. I want to gain an understanding of what I find to be one of the most challenging aspects of Torah, of Jewish thought, and that is the approach to war. We have a fundamental problem. Biblical text from the very beginning clearly prohibits murder. It's unequivocal. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech. One who spills the blood of a human being will have his blood spilled by others, will be punished, that the penalty is death for murder. And yet, we have this phenomenon called war, which the Torah very clearly sanctions. We have instructions on how to run your army. We have instructions on what to do when you go to war. The biblical accounts have righteous kings leading the nation out to war. So how do you accept, on the one hand, that we prohibit the murder of any human being and we value human life, and then on the other hand, we sanction and accept war? So that's the major question I want to address, along with the question of, if you are accepting war within a religious context, if somehow Judaism is able to reconcile itself to the idea that Jews are going to war against another population, how is such a war supposed to be conducted? The world has changed immensely since the Jews were en route from Egypt to what was then known as Canaan. The world's approach to war has evolved over the centuries. Even in the last 70 years, since the end of World War II, everything has changed in the world's approach to war, right? The bombing of Dresden, the explosion of nuclear bombs in Japan, those couldn't have happened today, the approach to what happens after war is over and how you determine victory, so to speak. These are all issues that have evolved over the last 70 years alone, let alone the centuries before that. So what is a Jewish approach to war? Those are the questions that I hope to deal with, along with some other fun topics along the way. You saw the flyer, then you saw the list of 6 tentative topics that I have on there. I want to discuss the issue of women in the military. It's a particularly interesting issue that fits in with this as well. There's quite a bit. Someone had emailed me as well. Maybe we could also get an opportunity to talk about some of the issues on campus and surrounding the response to Israel when Israel is at war. I don't know how we're going to get to everything. The answer is we have 6 weeks and we'll get to whatever we get to. But what I want to start with for this week and next week is the issue of what is termed just conduct in war. Meaning, going all the way back to Indian thought of thousands of years ago, there was something called a just war, just like justice. And a just war meant 2 things. Number one, that it has a just cause. And the other is that it is conducted in a just way. I want to talk about how it is conducted first, before getting to the issue of the cause for war and what is considered an acceptable cause. But this is what I want to address. Fundamentally, how can Jewish thought, how can Jewish tradition accept war? In what way is the war supposed to be conducted? What is the justification for it? These are the issues. I want to begin by taking a look, if you see on your sheet, I want to take a look at 3 biblical sources with this question that I put on your sheet of, does Judaism embrace the warrior? How does Judaism look at the soldier, the person who goes to war? If I were to ask you, before we even get into the sources, just for a sample of answers here, does Judaism respect, honor, tolerate, look down upon, how does Judaism look at those who actually wage its wars? Yes?
I think the Torah recognizes that war is a fact of life. It seems to be something that happens between nations, between people. And it's a guideline how to deal with it.
And then the warrior is looked at how?
Well, he has to, or she has to, conduct herself in certain ways.
So one way to look at it, Diane says, is that war is, you know, I'm repeating it now, is that war is a necessary evil, and evil is a strong word, but war is, I'm going to use the term because that's the popular phrase, that war is a fact of life, it's the way the world works, and that what we're getting, if I'm understanding you correctly, is not so much a desire to go to war as a recognition it's going to happen, and therefore this is how you do it, and therefore the soldier is not necessarily honored for it, but simply told, okay, fine, we need to have you do this, so this is how you're going to do it. That's what I'm getting from what you're saying. Okay, Sandy.
I think that many of the wars that were conducted by Israelites were God-proclaimed. And therefore, the soldier should be a messenger of God in the course of war. And if that were the case, there should be a certain behavior that is expected of that person. On the other hand, when you look at what God demanded of his soldiers, I think it's horrible in many of the cases of these wars that we'll probably have to deal with in this discussion.
Oh, yeah. We're not getting out of that one.
No. But I do think that because the wars were through the prophets, many of the wars were conducted in God's name for the sake of Israel, you know, to proclaim the state of Israel, the place that we would take over.
Right. So here we have, we already have 2 different ways to look at it. I think both could be anchored well in biblical sources. Sandy points out, wars in biblical texts are often declared by God. God says, you are supposed to go to war against X nation, and we'll talk about which nations those are and so on as we go forward in the coming weeks. And if so, it's hard to call it a fact of life. It becomes something that God initiated. On the other hand, if the warrior is supposed to be a representative of God, doing what God wants them to do, then it imposes certain expectations on the warrior. Sometimes those expectations may clash directly with what we believe to be correct. And sometimes those expectations may demand something higher, frankly, in terms of morality than what we expect from soldiers today. You find both ends of the spectrum. But I think what would come with that is a way to look at the warrior then as somebody to be honored. If I say war is simply a fact of life, you got to deal with it. So it's like any other job. We need plumbers, we need electricians, we need lawyers, and we need soldiers. I guess you'd rank those in order of preference. The other way to look at it, though, is to say, no, this is an honored person. This person is carrying out what God wanted. So that's another way to look at it. I'm going to take one more from this end of the table, because I can also turn my head left. Any additional thoughts on how we look at the warrior, and then we're going to see it from a text perspective? Yes?
I think a lot of what we look at the warrior is, again, almost a repetition, is the cause for which they were fighting, and the name in which they are fighting. David and Jonathan were warriors. And yet, if we go back earlier, we, with our today's sensibility in particular, when we wipe out the men, women, children, etc., is beyond what we would expect, no matter what the justice.
Correct. So that doesn't. So you're just pointing to the conflict issue.
I'm pointing more to the conflict than the image of the warrior.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, let's take a look. Take a look at source number one, please. This is a statement given to the Jews right after they have received the Ten Commandments at Sinai. It comes from the Torah portion called Mishpatim, which appears right after that incident, right after the Jews received the commandments at Sinai. There's some debate historically about exactly when the events of that Torah portion take place. Are they right before the golden calf? Are they after the golden calf? And that actually could impact on an understanding of this text. But just taking it very simply, God says to the Jews through Moshe, through Moses, talking about the tribes they will encounter when they enter the land of Canaan, you shall not make a covenant with them or their gods. In the Hebrew, lo sichros lahem vele Eloheihem bris. No covenants with them, no covenants with their gods. They shall not live in your land, meaning the land of Canaan, lest they incite you to sin against me. For you, that should say you, not your, for you will serve their gods, for they will be a stumbling block for you. This is very clearly a voice promoting war. And, to go back to what Sandy said, this is God saying, go to war with them, and you are my agent in this. Why? Because I am afraid, God says, that if you leave them in the land with you, you are going to follow them. And, frankly, as you read Tanakh, you find that that is precisely what happened. Right? The Jews became worshippers of the Baal, they became worshippers of the Asherah, the various idols that they found in the land became theirs. So, from a historical perspective, this certainly does come true. But this is a direct instruction to go to war, and in fact, as was mentioned before, great leaders, the people we are taught to look up to, within the Torah, the people we are told are righteous and close to God, double as warriors. Moses, who gives us the Torah, leads the Jews to war against Sihon and Og, kings of what are called the Amori, on the border of the land of Canaan. Joshua, who takes over for Moses, his first appearance in biblical text is leading the war against the nation of Amalek. Amalek attacks us, and he leads the response. He is identified as a warrior. In the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges, there is a woman by the name of Devorah, right? Deborah. So she tells Barak, the ostensible political leader of the Jews, to go to war against the Canaanites who are oppressing them. And when he is loath to go to war, when he says, "I don't want to go to war," so she makes fun of him. Right? She says, "Do you need a woman to lead you out to battle? Very well then, you will be victorious, but the credit is going to go to a woman instead of going to you." And that's considered to be an insult. Judges chapter 4 and chapter 5. So on the one hand, the Torah's voice for war is powerful, and it associates war with leadership. But that's only one side of things. Yes, Stephen?
I see the key here is the sin against me. The whole issue is based on that that one statement that God makes. Sin against me, and there should be no stumbling block, because I am holy, and you're created in my image to be holy. So my question would be very different. What is the opposite of the need to have war? In other words, God's people in their land are the example, the light, to influence all people in the world not to have war. So what is education more important than having the war?
Well,
to educate against
I think you are, as always, about three or four steps ahead of me. So we may get to that, but it's going to be like week six. In the topic that I listed, the topic of the war and the thought of Rabbi Cook, is what I hope to deal with that question of, is the Jew and is the Jewish nation meant to transcend war and to find another means of achieving these goals? So, you know, hopefully we get there, but it is on the agenda. Take a look at source number two, though, because I think number two is very important in presenting a different perspective. The Ten Commandments are recorded in the Torah in the 20th chapter of the book of Exodus, Shmot Chaf. As I noted, source number one is fairly soon after that. But in between the Ten Commandments and the laws that are brought in Parshat Mishpatim that you see in source number one, there's a little interlude in which God tells the Jews what sort of altar they should build when they want to serve God. They've just had this moment at Mount Sinai when they have this conversation with God, when God actually is speaking to them. And then he says, when you want to do this in the future, when you want to speak to me in the future, build this sort of an altar. And he gives them instructions. So one of the instructions he gives is not to have steps on the altar that for its own reasons. Another one of the instructions is source number two. Take a look at this. When you make an altar of stones for me, do not build it of hewn stone. You have raised your sword upon it and desecrated it. Okay, when you make an altar of stones for me, God says, do not build it of hewn stone, a stone that you have used a blade on, as it's explained here, in order to cut it to the shape that you want. Because you have raised your sword upon it and desecrated it. What message is this giving me regarding war? Using a weapon is wrong, or is?
It's not unholy.
It's unholy. Right. Contrast sharply with the image of the warrior as the agent of God carrying out God's word. Right? A very different perspective. And it's right there in the same biblical section. Take a look at number three. This is from the very end of the biblical text. It would have been a little easier on me if we had just said, let everybody bring a Tanakh, but because I didn't have the ability to reach everybody in advance, I figured better to just put it on the sheet. But if you do have a Tanakh and want to bring it, it'll help. But take a look at what you see here in source number three. This is from the book of Divrei Hayamim, rendered in English as Chronicles, and this is King David speaking. King David wishes to build a Beit HaMikdash, a temple for God. In the earlier biblical books, we're told he's not able to build it, but we aren't told why. We don't get the reason. We just get God saying, I don't want you to be the one to build it. However, in Divrei HaYamim, this book of Chronicles, we are told that David says the following, and the word of God came to me, you have spilled much blood, and you have made great wars. You shall not build a house in my name, for you have spilled much blood upon the ground before me. Sounds like a pretty harsh rejection. Right? David is ineligible to build a temple because he has been an agent of war. Yes?
It seems to me that it depends on whether the war is protective or aggressive.
Okay.
That would certainly determine how God would have seen the action of the war.
Well, David's wars tend to be defensive. or a response to a form of hostility, if not a direct threat. So some of them are response to direct, some of them are response to aggression. Think of the Philistines, for example, Goliath and so on. Some of them are perhaps better classified as a response to a non-threatening aggression, where, for example, there's a nation of Ammon who are allies is probably not exactly the right word, but they're on good terms with us, and the king dies, and David sends a delegation to console his son, and the son, in response, humiliates them, shaves off half of their beards, and sends them back with this humiliating message, and that results in David's forces going to war against Ammon. Is that to be viewed as a war of self-defense? Not exactly. On the other hand, it's not him; he's not picking a fight either. And then on the other hand, you have the tribes of Yevus who are living in the Jerusalem area, who David does go to war against, and they don't seem to pose a life and death threat to the Jewish people. But on the other hand, that's a war that God has commanded. My point is that I think that you could find within the biblical context and the system that God presents the Jews for war, you could find ample sanction for what David does. And yet, he's told, you can't build the temple, you have spilled blood. Joni. And then.
Maybe it's not a judgment. Maybe it's just a fact that he's saying, that's not your job. This is what you do. You're a warrior. You spill blood. You can't build the temple. He's not saying you can't go in the temple.
Right.
He's just saying, you're not the plumber. You're the warrior.
Right. Good. So maybe this is not punishment, but consequence.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Some of the commentators do suggest that when it says, you have spilled much blood upon the ground before me, it's a reference to the story of Uriah and Bathsheba and the death of that husband. It doesn't explain the great wars line, where he says, you have made great wars. But some do see that within this, that's the reference at the end. But the point about the consequence, I think it should not be lost, because it's one that we find throughout the Torah. In other classes, we've talked about the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and eating from the fruit and then suffering certain results. And there is a very, I think, very legitimate concept there of saying what happens to them is not a punishment. They were set up very much in a situation in which they would end up eating from this fruit. But eating from the fruit had certain results. Because you have done this, now this is the nature of your life, which is, it's beyond the scope of what we're going to do right now, where we'll never get back to discussing war. But the idea that not everything that happens is punishment, but simply, yeah, you're the warrior, this is what a warrior does, and he's ineligible, in fact, to do other things, is certainly a possibility. Marilyn was going to say something.
I actually learned to mention the lack of morality with Uriah. Mm.
Right. So we're not going to end up coming back to that one, because we would need a whole week for that topic. But it is, like I said, it does fit into this as well. Stephen.
King David united all the tribes?
Yes.
He has. But it does clearly say that God told David that your son will build the temple.
Yes. Well, it's not in this text, but in another text. Yes, indeed. So I think what we're seeing here, and what I wanted to get out of this introductory piece, is simply that we have conflicting messages which reflect a religion that is itself conflicted about the nature of war. Whether that's because war is simply fact of life and therefore we have to deal with it, whether it's because war is one role and it's separate from other aspects of Judaism, or whether there are other answers to it. This is something that we're going to see repeatedly. So looking at this, I want to move to the next section here, which is the ideal Jewish warrior. And this is part one. This is going to extend into next week. But what exactly is this warrior supposed to be like? Take a look, please, at source number 4. Many of the laws governing going to war appear either towards the end of the book of Numbers or, more prominently, in the book of Deuteronomy, Bamidbar Devarim. And the reason is, of course, because at that point the Jews are on the border of the land of Canaan. They're about to go in and their actual wars begin. The only war they have prior to that point is when they are attacked by the nation of Amalek, or in another incident by a group of Canaanites when they're still in the wilderness. So, take a look at what you see here in source number 4, this passage, regarding preparations for war. The scene that's being set here is that there is a Kohen, a priest, who is in charge of addressing the Jews who are going to go to war. And there are also military officers who are going to address the nation before they go to war. So here is an address by the officers. And the officers shall address the nation, and they say the following: Who has built a new home and not dedicated it? He shall return home, lest he die in war, and another man dedicate it. And who has planted a vineyard and not used it? He shall return home, lest he die in war, and another man use it. And who has betrothed a woman and not wedded her? Because indeed in this passage the warriors are males. So who has betrothed a woman and not wedded her? He shall return home, lest he die in war, and another man wed her. End of the quote. And the officers shall continue to address the nation. Who is afraid and of soft heart? He shall return home, lest he melt the hearts of his brothers like his own heart. Why these? Why these three? Before you get to the last one of who has afraid and of soft heart, why these examples? Are they examples of something greater? Are they specific?
There wouldn't be any soldiers if they followed. There wouldn't be any. Practically covered everything.
Yeah, you think that they're... Which one do you think is going to get the most people to back out?
The heart.
You think so?
No. The land.
So some actually suggest that the first three are cover.
Are what?
Are cover. Meaning, if someone wants to leave because he is of soft heart, but he's embarrassed to say so... Right? It's sort of like when you go to give blood and they tell you, they give you the sticker or whatever, and they say, you can tell them, you put the sticker where you want, and then the blood will be used or not be used, and you don't have to tell anybody anything. Do you know what I'm talking about? Those who give blood. So that's sort of what this reminds me of. Like, you can tell people it's because you have a vineyard or because you betrothed somebody, and that way no one will know the real reason, which is actually number 4, all of the above, so to speak. That's one possibility. But why? What do you think about these first three? Yes?
Well, I'm just thinking these guys are building a nation, and that's probably just as important as to going to war.
Mm.
You can't do one without the other, so... Some will do this and some will do that.
Good. These aren't three random things. These are nation-building things. And so the understanding is we need people who are going to engage in this battle, but we also need people who will build houses, who will create families, who are going to establish vineyards. Both of these are necessities. And so we're saying this is another possibility. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting to note that I think it's Maimonides in his discussion of laws of marriage. He gives you the order of things, the order in which one should go about creating a life. And so he says, find a place to live, make sure you have a parnasa, a way to support yourself, that's the vineyard, and then you get married. Sometimes we see it doesn't quite work that way. But that's his... But that's the idea, that this is, in fact, this is the way... These three are sort of society-building things. Very good. What else do we see here? All about continuing life, absolutely. The emphasis of... I'm sorry, there's a hand that I'm not seeing. Yeah. Oh, there you are.
I'm here somewhere. That perhaps because these are unfinished situations, that the fear is that the soldiers will be thinking about what they still have to do at home and they won't have their minds on war.
Right. their heads are going to be elsewhere. And I think that's emphasized with the second half of each of these, where it's not just you built a home, you didn't get to dedicate it yet, you would like to use your house. It's also the fear that's in the back of his head of, hey, who's going to end up there if something happens to me on the battlefield? And ditto for the marriage and ditto for the vineyard. There is this sort of anguish piece of things that's going to really distract people and draw them away from the focus that they need to have. Take a look at source number 5, please. Source number 5 develops this further, talking about the instructions that are given to the nation, this address that we saw in number 4. The sages in the Mishnah, remember how the Talmud works. We've discussed it on other occasions, but just a very fast digest. We have this biblical text like you see in number 4. It is accompanied by explanation, which is transmitted by tradition, where as people teach the verses, they also teach the meaning of it. And that's clear as you read biblical text that it requires further explanation, and that historically was done, as many cultures did, as a verbal tradition until the Jews get to the Roman era. And the Romans, we're talking now to 2,000 plus years ago, the Romans find that these pesky Jews keep rebelling against them and making life miserable for them. And finally they say, we need to break the back of the Jewish people. And one of their methods is to outlaw the teaching of Torah and the ordaining of scholars on penalty of death. And not just death for those involved, but death for those who have nothing to do with it. So, for example, they say, if we catch anyone ordaining a new rabbi, we will kill the ordainer, we will kill the ordainee, and we will also kill the Jewish population of the nearest town. That's their way of putting a halt, which is brutal and is effective. And a society in which all these things are being taught teacher to student, if you can't actually teach teacher to student, how is it going to be transmitted? How is anyone going to learn? It eliminates the possibility of transmitting this. And so, things begin to be forgotten. And so they decide we have to write down our spoken tradition. Even though they liked the fact that it was verbal, because when something is transmitted verbally, you have control. You know exactly who is learning it, because no one can just find out the information. You know exactly to whom you're teaching it. There's an element of control that goes with it. There's also an element of flexibility when something is verbal. The student can ask a question and get an answer. You can say, well, what do I do about this situation? What do I do about that? As opposed to text, where you read something and it's subject to everybody's interpretation and you don't know the intent of the writer. Nonetheless, it's a concession to reality. And so they first record the tradition in an outline of laws called the Mishnah, which is canonized in the city of Tzipori, right near the Kinneret, in the Galilee. It's canonized in the beginning of the 3rd century, and then there's an expanded version of that, which includes much more discussion, areas that relate to law, that relate to other things, and that's called Gemara, and that is canonized in the middle of the 6th century. There are two parts to that, but that's beyond the scope of what we're going to do right now. Mishnah plus Gemara together are the Talmud. So when you see in source number 5, Talmud Sota 44b, this is a passage from the Talmud. It appears in the volume called Sota on the page 44b. And we begin with a Mishnah. This Mishnah says the following. Rabbi Akiva said, when the text says afraid and of soft heart, that someone who is afraid and of soft heart should return home, he says, that's as it sounds. Meaning, he cannot stand in the battles of war and see a drawn sword. We're talking about somebody who says, I don't like the sight of blood. Right? Especially my own. That's what Rabbi Akiva says. This is a very practical point. I don't want a warrior out there who is going to flinch when it's time to draw weapons. That's his view. However, Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, Rabbi Yossi of the Galil, disagreed. Rabbi Yossi HaGalili said, afraid and of soft heart is one who is afraid due to his sins. Someone who is spiritually afraid, who says, you know, I haven't been the best person, and I am afraid that God is not going to protect me on the battlefield. It's a spiritual fear, as opposed to the sort of physical fear that Rabbi Akiva defines. And Rabbi Yosef Glili says, therefore, the Torah gave him all of these justifications for returning home. So he doesn't have to tell people, yeah, I'm a sinner, and that's why. He can say, forgot, vineyard. My vineyard's waiting for me. I think I hear my new house calling. That's the Mishnah. This is a debate. Now, we know when Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yosef Glili live. This debate that's going on is the end of the first century, beginning of the second century. We know this because Rabbi Akiva, for example, is very involved in the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which is put down by the Romans in the year 135. That's already towards the end of Rabbi Akiva's life. So we know that these are people, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi Aglili, are quite familiar with war. Right? They're part of this Jewish world which is in revolt against the Romans, and they give two different explanations for why somebody might leave the battlefield. One, regular physical fear, the other says spiritual fear, and then on that we get this passage of Gemara in source number 5, which tries to explain what do you mean when Rabbi Yossi Aglili says someone who is afraid due to his sins. What kind of a sin would cause somebody to be afraid? To which he says, one who speaks between his arm and head tefillin has transgressed and returns from the battlefield. And what the Talmud here is talking about is the following. Tefillin, phylacteries, are made up of arm and head tefillin. The first one is the arm one. It's put up. It's put on the bicep beside the heart. Assuming you're a righty. If you're on a lefty, then your heart presumably is on the other side of your chest. No, but a lefty puts it on the right arm. But it is put on the arm. Straps are wrapped around the arm, and then there's the head tefillin, which has a knot that goes back here, and which has a box that goes up above the original hairline. No comments. But they're supposed to be done one right after the other. The arm tefillin and then the head tefillin. One isn't supposed to speak in between. What they're saying here is, speaking in between the two, interrupting between the arm and the head tefillin, counts as a transgression such that somebody would not go to war. So someone said before, once you have this list, it seems like everyone is going to leave the battlefield. Once you tell me that that's your criteria, for sure everybody's going to leave the battlefield. Meaning this is, on the scale of sins that we are familiar with, this one is barely perceptible to most people. The idea that, what, he put on his arm tefillin and then he paused and got into a conversation with somebody and now he's no longer acceptable as a soldier. Like, what are you going to, how are you going to, how are you going to field an army anymore? Karen.
Well, if you interrupt, then perhaps the rationality that's required in the field isn't going to be brought into play.
What do you mean? Explain that.
Well, if you're saying if you're interrupting, if it's a flow from emotion, heart, to rationality, head, if they are the kind of person on the battlefield who goes with the emotion only and doesn't think, you don't want that kind of person on the battlefield.
Interesting. So that's one way to look at it, is that it's the emotion of the heart and the intellect of the brain. Another approach that's brought is to suggest that it's because the head is indeed viewed as the seat of one's thought. Although, historically, was it always so is a good question, but the idea would be the head is the seat of one's thought and the arm is one's action. And your actions have to be infused with thought. It can't just be, I'm going to act impulsively, and therefore you don't want an interruption between the two. That's another similar way to look at it, that it's symbolic when we bring this as an example. Yeah? Interesting. Would you say the same thing, though, regarding the marriage one?
Well, it's partly women's property still.
Interesting. I'm not sure that would fit, though. I mean, that requires really its own, like, its own discussion of whether that's the outlook.
And concern that someone else will benefit from the property.
Right. No, I get the idea. I'm not sure I would see it, though. I'm going to leave it with there, just because anything to try to defend against it would take an awful lot of time. I hear the idea.
It's the loss of focus.
Yeah, no, that I hear. The one way to look at this, in terms of the example that's brought, this example of the tefillin and speaking between the head and the arm tefillin, is that it's meant to underscore something. It's meant to say that the warrior is supposed to be somebody of high, and not just high, but the highest spiritual character. That when the statement is made here, when Rabbi Akiva says afraid means, yeah, you're afraid of getting hurt on the battlefield, that's normal. Right? That's just a normal human trait. And he's saying we need warriors who are courageous and who are not going to look at their concern for their own health. Rabbi Yossi Aglili is making a dramatically different statement. Rabbi Yossi Aglili says, no, what the biblical text is telling me is I want warriors who do not need to fear because of any blemish on their spiritual record. I want warriors who are spiritually superlative. And what the Talmud is adding to that in source number 5 is saying so much so that even the slightest of sins, right, they put on their tefillin and they make sure they don't speak in between the head and the arm tefillin. Even that's how high a spiritual level we demand of this Jewish warrior. That's what Rabbi Yossi Aglili is adding, according to some explanations of this passage about the arm and the head tefillin. Both of these elements, the need for confidence as well as the need for a high religious level, are seen in the following story. If you take a look at source number 6, this comes from the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges. This is a period when the Jews are oppressed by the Canaanites. They have to pay tribute to them and so on. And a fellow by the name of Gideon is told by God to lead the Jews in revolt. But God wants Gideon, just trying to think whether it's Canaan or Midian. I think maybe Midian he's fighting against. But the statement that, God sends, he sends Gideon to lead the Jews in battle, in rebellion against Midian. But he says to him, I don't want you to bring all the Jews out. I don't want you to have a massive army. If you have a massive army, then when you win, you know what people are going to say? It was our army that did it. As the biblical text says, "Kochi va'otzem yadi," it was my strength that did it. It was my strong hand, the strength of my hand that did it. So God says, I want you to reduce your military. Reduce the number of people you are going to use against Midian. I want the miracle to be clear. And he says, I'm going to tell you how to reduce your force. I want you to take your thirsty soldiers down to the water. And this is what we're up to in source number 6. And he took the nation down to the water, he being Gideon. And God said to Gideon, all who lap with their tongues from the water like a dog laps, you shall set aside. And all who kneel on their knees to drink, those are the ones who aren't going to battle. And the number who lap with their hands to their mouths, that's the okay method of drinking, is picking up the water with your hands. Then those were 300 men. The rest kneeled on their knees to drink water. Why choose that method to weed out those you don't want? Loretta.
If you lap like a dog, your eyes are down, you can't see who's coming. If you take your hand like that, you can still see what's happening. You can be observant around you.
Interesting. Military strategy. But what about the one who kneels? They're getting closer to the water. But their head isn't down, presumably. They're not lapping. In other words, there are two that he disqualifies. Yeah. But that would be a very interesting military insight.
And then they're not aware of what's going on around them in battle.
Right, that's like Loretta said, they're not aware. That's true, they can't get up so quickly. It depends also on how old these warriors are. But yes. Remember that the military in biblical times, certainly if you go back to the Jews in the wilderness, it's 20 to 60. I'm thinking about what happens like when you get towards the upper end there. They're not getting down on their knees to drink from the river, that's for sure. But what else? Other explanations? Yes?
Well,
already told he wants them to have a small army. He's already said, I don't want all of these people. So this is only the method of weeding them out, but he's going to reduce the force in any case. He's already said he doesn't want them. Yeah?
This is a more sophisticated and more thoughtful individual who does this. The others behave in a purely animalistic manner. Like a dog,
yes.
It is more animalistic, just thirsty, jump down into the water. This way you're taking your time and you're bringing the water to you. There has a certain element there of restraint and thoughtfulness.
Right, you ever watch a bunch of teenage boys sit down to a meal? The
in the second commentary, you say because idolatry.
Right, so good. So take a look at number 7. Number 7 brings two commentaries, one from Rashi, writing in the 11th century, and the other one from Ralbag, writing 150 or so years later, maybe a little later than that. Yeah, early 14th century, I believe. Ralbag, also known as Gersonides, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, both of them classic commentators. Take a look. Rashi says that the reason to discard the ones who kneel is because they are familiar with kneeling thus before their idolatry. That's the concern that Rashi identifies. Kneeling is associated with idolatry. Now, even though one might contend that in Rashi's day, kneeling is associated with idolatry, because Rashi is familiar, very familiar with Christianity and a practice of kneeling in worship, we do find it biblically with older forms of worship. So don't make the anachronistic association with Christian worship per se. But the Rashi's statement is that they are kneeling thus before their idolatry, and that's why they kneel this way when they drink. It's a natural position for them. Ralbag tends to be more practical. And so he says, God did not want these to stay with him, with Gidon, other than those who lapped with their hands to their mouths, which demonstrated energy and strength. Those who kneeled on their knees to drink were lazy. He wants the ones who are stronger. It's a very Ralbag comment. That's his general approach. Well, is it far-fetched? Oh, go ahead.
No, I just think it's far-fetched, really pushing the point.
I don't know. I think it's an interesting idea. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that the expression fall to their knees shows weakness, not so much laziness. So if it's symbolic to being weak, they fell on the knees, then they couldn't handle the situation.
Right. Like, you're demonstrating energy and strength. So it's not only about laziness, but it's about physical capacity. True. You were going to say before?
But on the other hand,
yeah,
if you're doing something quickly to get it over with, you're conserving your energy so that you don't have to use so much energy when you go to battle.
It's a good point. You could argue the other way. Yes.
I'm just trying to picture getting close enough to the water to scoop up a handful, and
it takes more energy to do that.
Yeah, like you're getting close enough to do it.
Right, and the answer is I don't know. I mean, we're missing information here in terms of the scene. This isn't a movie, unfortunately. Yes, Stephen, and then I'm going to make one point with this.
I'll say that with two hands if you want to. The practicality of Ralbag is that the ideal way to drink the water is with a ladle or a cup. That, if you accept that, then there's no need to kneel down, which is not just lazy, it's an interruption of your duty as a warrior to be on the alert every moment. So if you scoop down and reach up because you don't have the cup, you're using your hand as a cup, which is the most efficient way.
Right, it's kind of surprising there wasn't some guy, some enterprising person on the side selling cups to them. My point in bringing this is not so much to actually, analyze whether it's possible and how it's possible, as interesting as that is, but rather to show you the way Rashi and Ralbag mirror Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi. Meaning, Rabbi Akiva said it's a practical issue. Right? The person who's afraid, and therefore we're told go home, is the person who is weak. Not weak necessarily physically, but is not going to be able to fight well. We're looking for warriors who are capable. That's one approach. The other approach is the approach taken by Rashi, and Rashi is with Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, right? The approach that says we're looking for the warrior who is going to be on a high spiritual level, right? Rabbi Yossi HaGalili says we send home the one who says, well, I've sinned and therefore I'm not eligible, which means we're keeping the ones who say, I am very careful with my practices. And Rashi with that says, we're dismissing the ones who kneel for idolatry. So the first piece of this is to see an outgrowth of what we have already said in the beginning. We said that there's an element of conflict where in some ways we elevate the warrior. And we say the warrior is doing God's mission and the warrior is righteous and so on. And then on the other hand, we're not happy about this idea of going to war, and we say the warrior, for whatever reason, punishment or consequence, is unfit to build the temple. The blade does not belong on the altar, and the person we're going to send to war, at least we're going to send somebody who is as righteous as possible. We want to make sure that we're going to send out the righteous people to battle. I think there are other ways to look at it, but I'm trying to show the way that within our tradition we really have these two different streams of looking at war. Moving ahead a little bit with this, one theme that is constant in the biblical imperatives for war, as well as in rabbinic commentary, is the importance of keeping your humanity, keeping your discipline, and keeping your mercy. We see it you see it on multiple levels, but let's take a look first at the issue of leadership in battle. Take a look at source number 8, please. Source number 8 comes from the Torah portion called Pinchas, the latter part of the book of Numbers. This is when the Jews are in their 40th year in the wilderness, and God has just told Moses, you are not entering the land of Canaan with the Jews. Karen.
Because he struck.
Right. So Garrett makes a very interesting point, which is worth exploring for a moment. We're familiar with the fact that Moses is not allowed to enter the land, even though for 40 years he has done everything God asked of him, and even though originally, in the beginning of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, God charged him with his mission and said, I am going to send you to bring the Jews into the land. So why doesn't he actually get to lead them in? So there are many explanations, but they all center on one key story. And that is, in the Jews' 40th year in the wilderness, they at one point lose the supply of water. The water supply that they had was a well that actually, we are told, traveled with them miraculously. And this is the well of Miriam, in the merit of Miriam. After Miriam passes away, the well disappears. The Jews need water. They come to Moses and say, excuse me, we have a problem. And Moses, of course, goes back to God and says, now what? And God says, no problem, take your staff, go out in front of the nation, and go to the rock and speak to the rock, and water will come from it. And Moses goes out and he strikes the rock. He declares to the nation, is it possible that we can bring water for you from this stone? And he strikes the rock twice and water comes out. And God says, that was a big oops. God says to him, that was wrong. You failed to sanctify me and therefore you are not going to bring the Jews into the land. What in the world is that about? Why does that warrant him not? I mean, they're talking about somebody who led the Jews in so many ways over such a period of time, defended them after the golden calf, set them straight after the spies, brought the Torah down from Sinai. He's not making it in because he hit the rock. Not only that, the story gets more complex because this isn't the first time that he brought water from a stone. Right after they got out of Egypt, they needed water. And there, right after they crossed through the sea, the way that he brought them water was God told him, there's a rock, go out, take your staff, and hit the rock. So he's only working from experience. Not to mention, God said to him, go out in front of the nation with your staff. So it's not like the staff is unfamiliar to him. It's not like it doesn't belong there. It's almost like God is misleading him, right? Like, here you go, bring your staff, but talk to the rock. It's very difficult to understand. So there are multiple explanations, of course, that are offered, because we're Jews. One explanation that's offered is that actually there's nothing wrong with hitting the rock, but the text specifies that he hit it twice. And the crime of failure to sanctify God's name, as it's mentioned there in the verse, is because it seems like the miracle isn't working. Like he hits the rock, and then he needs to hit it again. It shows weakness on the part of God, if that's the way the miracle has to work. And there are all sorts of explanations for why he hit it twice. That's one approach. Another approach is, it's the way he addressed the nation. He said to them, Shimuna Hamorim. He begins by saying, listen up, you rebellious people. And that's an inappropriate way for a leader to address the nation. And God says, okay, you're fired. You can't speak to them that way. That's another approach. But another approach, and this goes back to what Joni said about consequence versus punishment, is to suggest that there was a lesson here. In the first year in the wilderness, it's fine to hit the rock. And indeed, that's what he was supposed to do. In the early days of it, because it's the wilderness and because it's not the sacred land of Israel and because you just got out of Egypt with this group of slaves, it's fine to hit the rock and the display of force may be impressive and fine and whatever. But when you get to year 40, you can't lead that way anymore. It has to be a conversation. It has to be by speech. It can't be by force. And therefore, the message is, your time is done. That was the way to lead them in the past, but if you're going to keep leading them this way, you can't be the one to take them into the land. We need a new approach. So that's another idea, and there's more to be said about all of this. But that's, you're right, the idea of hitting the rock as being what disqualifies him from entering the land would fit this idea. Thank you. But take a look at this piece about leadership. After God has told Moses, you're not going to enter the land, in source number 8, so Moses turns around to God. I think the most common verse in the Torah is Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor, or some version of that. And God spoke to Moses saying. So this section actually begins with Vayidaber Moshe, or Vayomer Moshe el Hashem le'mor. And Moses spoke to God saying. He turns it around. And he says, I'd like a word with you about my successor. He says, let God appoint, because I had to skip some for space, a man over the assembly who will go before them and come in before them and bring them out and bring them in. And let the nation of God not be like sheep without a shepherd. So we could take a lot of time analyzing this, but in the interest of time, I'm going to bring you Rashi's explanation right here in this source. Rashi explains the meaning of the statement of a man over the assembly who will bring them out and bring them in, go before them, come before them. What is that about? So Rashi says, not like the kings of the nations who sit at home and send their soldiers to war. Rather, Moses says, as I did. I fought with Sichon and Og. Moses' message is, whoever is going to take over has to be at the front. The king leads the Jews to war, and the king brings them back from war. As a matter of fact, later kings and leaders of the Jewish people would be criticized when they failed to do this. Joshua is rebuked at one point for failing to do this. The leader has to be among the people. And why is that? Why do you need the leader to be with the nation, leading them out to war? Obviously, part of it is morale, right? You don't feel so good when the leader is safe back home. But part of it is sensitivity. To be among the nation, to be aware of what the soldiers are going through. You don't just send people out, but you're actually on the front lines with them. It means that you're going to know what they're up against, and you're going to know the problems that they're dealing with, and you have to experience it along with them, and you won't subject them to anything that you don't have to deal with as well. It's a powerful statement to a nation. So that's sort of step one of the instructions to Jews about how you wage war, is the leaders have to do it in the right way. The leaders have to be there. The leaders have to be as invested as the soldiers themselves, and more so because they are literally at the front. That's the way that it's worded here. There's so much more I want to get to, but I'm going to do a very fast summary of what we've seen. We started out by talking about the key question of, since the Torah prohibits murder, how can the Torah sanction war? And how is such a war meant to be conducted? We pointed out that within the biblical text itself, as seen in source 1 versus sources 2 and 3, we get different voices. On the one hand, we have a source that's powerful in its voice on behalf of war, and on the other hand, there seems to be some discomfort involved with it. in disqualifying the person from serving, from building the temple, disqualifying use of metal to shape the stones of the Mizbeach, of the altar. We see the same thing when it comes to the description of the Jewish warrior and the reason why he goes home. Does he leave the battlefield because he's not confident? Does he get sent home from Gideon's war because he is weak? Or is it about righteousness? Does he go home because he has sinned? Does he get dismissed from Gideon's army because he has some association with kneeling for idolatry? And last, we saw this need for the leader to be a part of this. The leader has to be involved in leading from the front. There's much more to say. God willing, we will continue with this next week. Again, as I said in the beginning, first of all, please make sure you're signed in with your email address so that I will be able to email you follow-up from the class and the link when I upload the audio. And please do... where is the sheet? Sorry, where is the sheet? Okay. Shh. Want to make sure that please make sure that you do see Loretta. Make sure that you are signed in. If you, we can all close our eyes and have someone return the sign-in sheet, and no one will know.